Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you're listening to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. For the people of the Dawnland, they were floating islands. The sails resembled clouds, and the men gathered on deck looked like bears. When Europeans came ashore, whether Danes in what would become Newfoundland, or English settlers in the land they named Virginia, their mastery of the oceans did not translate into supremacy on land. Small conflicts and colonial enclaves evolved into transatlantic wars that transformed the political and social worlds of millions. Europeans were people of the oceans, fanning out across the globe in vessels that pursued and extracted natural resources while doubling as weapons of war. For some time now, historians have approached the Atlantic as an integrated and connected world, defined by the movement of people, goods, and ideas. In Atlantic wars from the 15th century to the Age of Revolution, just published by Oxford University Press, Geoffrey Plank, professor of early modern history at the University of East Anglia here in the UK, uses war as a lens to examine the interactions of peoples who forge shared experiences amid endemic conflict. The result is a sweeping and masterly synthesis of the intermingling of European, indigenous, and African histories, which connects the Atlantic with continental, Pacific, and oceanic perspectives. Jeff Plank joins me from Norfolk. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
So I just want to talk about first, I mean, this is a large transnational, transtemporal book that takes us from South America, North America, across Europe to Africa, and places in between. I want to talk first about how you got started on this project. Why did you decide to embark on something this ambitious?
Well, it's been a long journey. I started my career studying the French colony of Acadia, which is conquered by the British and becomes Nova Scotia, and I incorporated the experience of Mi'kmaq and Acadians and British. And in that project, I was really early on grappling with the problem of borders and how you confine a topic within, you know, one frame or another, the French Empire, the British Empire, North America, and eventually moving on to the Atlantic. And since then, I've studied other, Atlantic scale problems. The idea of this book came up pretty much parallel with the book my earlier book on Quakers, and one of the strange sort of connections between the two is this perception that the whole world is impacting people where they live. And this was something that really concerned the Quaker John Woolman, that his economy in rural New Jersey was connected to warfare in Africa and naval warfare all over the Atlantic world. And so the issues he was worried about are in some ways parallel to the issues that I'm trying to work with in this, a crazily large book.
Well, not crazily. It's totally under control. I just wanted to turn to this issue of colonialism, but I mean that's an important point, that the people in colonial worlds were connected in all kinds of ways to a global web of networks of exchange and various other things. And that trend in scholarship has really illustrated worlds that we didn't know before. But you, in this book, provide us with a really powerful reminder by positioning war and violence and militarism as a driver of imperial and colonial activity. And you say and remind us that colonies were, quote, military projects. I wonder if you could say more about what you mean by that and give us some examples, perhaps.
Well, yeah, they were military projects because every colony needed military force to survive in the Atlantic world. And I guess ships are really central to my whole conception of this, that ships were armed vessels designed to withstand attack and to attack. And basically everybody who relied on ships was, in a sense, feeding into, benefiting from, or suffering from a long-standing pattern of European conflict at sea and the technology that developed from that. So then moving forward, so the dispossession of peoples, the distribution of resources, huge patterns of migration, largely dependent on ships and also on conflict in various parts of the Atlantic world. The labor system depended on warfare as well. So to say that the colonies are military in their character does not mean that there's fighting going on all the time. And I think it's very important to remember that people could live entire lives without, facing conflict in various parts of the Atlantic world. But to the extent that they were tied into the trade networks and especially the system of Atlantic slavery, their lives were profoundly affected and shaped by the military character of exchange across the Atlantic world.
So shipping and seafaring and wars at sea are a central component of the book. What is it about European shipping that makes Europeans such effective sort of global imperialists? What is it? Is it technological? Is it organizations like the Royal Navy? What's the driver?
Well, I think it is technological initially. As I say at the beginning of the book, it is part of the story here is that the Atlantic is not navigated, not crossed routinely until very late. And if you think about it in world history, that's one of the things that distinguishes it from other oceans. And so the fact that the Europeans took these mature sailing vessels across the ocean and met people who didn't have a comparable technology gives them an advantage initially that's very important. And then once the Atlantic economy gets going, it has a lot to do with investment in infrastructure, the ports facilities and basically linking together, outposts that ships can visit and operate from.
So when we think about European empires, I suppose most people who think about European imperialism maybe think of the British Empire and maps that are colored with great washes of color to demonstrate the possession of land. Mm-hmm. But this book, for me, served as a sort of a reminder that European imperial power came through water and maritime channels, more so than land, and that empire was a thing of water as opposed to land. To what extent is that the case?
I think it's very definitely the case early on, and actually longer, I think, than a lot of people appreciate, that a lot of the major confrontations in the 16th century are about port facilities, about shipping lanes. I'm thinking particularly about a very climactic set of battles around the Azores Islands in the 1580s, involving rival factions of Portuguese and Spanish and French, and then later English and Dutch get involved in the battles. The people engaged in this, and this is one of the biggest overseas efforts the French ever launch in the 16th century, it's all about controlling a place for ships to visit, and the empire is understood to depend on, owning the shipping lanes or controlling the shipping lanes.
So there's the ocean is a series of territories that then sort of extend onto land. Mm-hmm. How the people that they encounter, let's just talk a little bit about sort of the indigenous populations, perhaps. I mean, the societies that Europeans encounter, Europeans notoriously go out across the Atlantic with certain expectations of the cultures that they're going to encounter. And when they do encounter them, they form a set of other assumptions. But the indigenous and island and African cultures that the book deals with, these people have a military culture of their own.
Right. Yes, and then it's a very effective military culture in most contexts. I mean, in a sense, you know, it's one of the bleak stories I want to kind of get across here is that you know, I don't want to be universal about this, but it's very common for societies around the Atlantic before even the beginning of Columbus to be organized militarily, to be prepared militarily, and when Europeans arrive in various places, you know, Africa is the most dramatic example. Really, they are, you know, in many places overmatched by the African military cultures that they encounter. They don't know how to engage with them effectively, and in large parts of Africa, Europeans are excluded for large part because of military action against them.
So, what is then the secret to European power? I mean, how do they move around? How do they contend with indigenous power sort of pushing back at them?
Almost everywhere, the key is alliances with indigenous people in various parts of the Atlantic world. I start the book talking about the Norse in Newfoundland and their brief effort to establish an outpost there. And I think there are at least two things that make that effort fail. And one is the inadequacy of their sailing vessels to efficiently maintain connections with Greenland or Europe. But the other thing is that they completely fail to even communicate effectively with the indigenous people around them. And what happens later is that you get much more complex networks, and a big part of those networks is the participation of indigenous Americans and Africans as well as Europeans in, you know, it's in the economy as well as in you know, military action.
So the world then, the Atlantic world, when to go back to the sort of the Atlantic paradigm, the Atlantic mm-hmm. world as being one that's integrated, it's not only integrated in purely imperial terms mm-hmm. where, for example, Caribbean planters move easily across the Atlantic and there's inter-imperial trade and what have you, but in fact, indigenous populations, African populations are drawn in and in some cases shape the character of that interaction.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think, obviously we always have a different kind of evidentiary base talking about the European and colonial angles on this, but especially African historians are drawing on, you know, especially the Portuguese sources and others to fill out a lot of the story about African conflict and the ways that military culture in Africa has something to big a part to do with the slave trade and how the slave trade develops. There's a whole other literature about Maroon communities in the Americas, which also emphasizes African military traditions continuous reinforcement of African culture within enslaved populations, which continues into the 19th century. You can see African military things all over the Atlantic world, you know, for the whole period that I'm studying in this book.
And in terms of the American Northeast, which is an enormously complex sort of space and period between the late 17th century and the American Revolution. What's going on there in terms of warfare and power rivalry in broad strokes? What do you see happening there?
Well, I mean, this is, I think this is, as I said, this is, that's the area where I started my career. It's, it is, like you say, extremely complicated. And I think one of the things that we are, as you know, scholars in general are increasingly realizing is the persistent presence of Indigenous Americans in and around New England. And as, you know, people aren't surprised at all to know that they were in and around the French colonies and the Northeastern North America. I agree that with Emerson Baker and John Reed made this argument 15, 20 years ago that the Abenaki and their allies, there's a whole area just south of the St. Lawrence River, a big area that remains basically under indigenous control going into the second half of the 18th century. And I think part of the story of Northeastern North America, if you think about Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and especially, it follows a chronological pattern, which is common across much of the Atlantic world, which is the turning point is around the time of the Revolutionary Era, where suddenly you get a much larger influx of European colonists. And, you know, that coincides with a lot of other changes, which, you know, basically until then, you have a very powerful indigenous military presence. The Mi'kmaq terrify the British when they come to Nova Scotia. But things change around the time of the American Revolution.
And that presumably is tied to the fact that the British were compelled to enter into agreements with their indigenous neighbors, not out of a position of outright imperial strength, but sort of as a pragmatic exercise in balancing their power, because they were, after 1763, suddenly widely extended. So is there something to be said about when the United States, the onset of the Republic, there's a distinct change in attitude towards not only indigenous peoples, but also the enslaved?
Again, I think this is an issue that it's very helpful. I'm certainly not the first person to say this, to think about these issues on an Atlantic scale. Mm-hmm. The Haitian Revolution is critical, I think, for shaping American perceptions of race in, especially in a military context. But basically what happens in around that era is that the idea of allying the United States, and this is a common perception of, you know, not just within the United States, it's also increasingly it spreads around the Atlantic world, that Europeans and the descendants of colonists do not make alliances with indigenous people outside their own borders. It's sort of a big international agreement, basically, that the old world of that messy tangle of alliances, that shifting alliances around the Atlantic world, gets replaced by a nation-state system, which basically leaves the leaders of each nation-state to govern their own affairs, and in general, they associate the indigenous and enslaved peoples within their populations as people who can only work in cooperation with their sovereign, and each area has its sovereign, and enslaved people, freed people, and indigenous people are generally not considered worthy of sovereignty. And I guess, can I say one more thing about that? The big, messy, violent story that I tell, going from the 15th century to the Age of Revolution, is a story of violence committed by, the whole variety of people living around the Atlantic world. And what happens in the Revolutionary Era, another thing that happens is a sort of reinterpretation of that earlier history, so that the peculiar violence of that early period is basically attached to indigenous people and Africans, which is, I think, obviously one of the distortions of history that serves a purpose for the people of the 19th century. And it's something, obviously, that we have to overcome ourselves.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's there, isn't it, in the Declaration of Independence and in the reference to the merciless Indian savages whose only known way of war is the destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And it's also there in the vivid memory of the wars that take place in the colonies in the 17th century, for example, Metacom's War, which is a very bloody affair. So that memory of violence conditions people's attitudes going forward, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's interesting, though, what the book shows is the extent to which indigenous powers push back. And I was really drawn to a really strong parallel when you describe the Viking settlement in what we now call Newfoundland. They construct palisades, and it's kind of, we don't think of Vikings as having to defend themselves against another power. And of course, Virginians do the same thing in the early 17th century. And when the imperial infrastructure kind of emerges, it's one that's defined by a military infrastructure, forts along lakes, rivers, and coasts, outposts, and things of this sort. So in a sense, when does that militarism never really goes away, does it? It's just a question of scale.
You mean the need for infrastructure, the need for, No, I don't think it ever does go away. I mean, it changes its form, many times over, but, exactly. I mean, my book ends with the revolutionary era, and I do think the world is different afterwards, but. Yeah, I mean,
there are forts. I mean, if you look at a map of the contemporary Northeast, I mean, there's fort this and there's fort that. What changes, though, after the revolutionary era? What's the argument there?
Many things change. One of the things that runs through this book, and if you go back to thinking about the Vikings or the early Virginians in their fear of, or the way they're constrained by indigenous military power, a big part of that is because they do not have a comparable device like the ship gives them power at sea. There's nothing like that that gives them power on land. And eventually they do get, I mean, the descendants of colonists do get overwhelming power on land. It's partly to do with transportation infrastructure, literally, the roads and railroads. They're the biggest one. And then mass migration of people, the whole scale of settlement changes in the 19th century. And then you get this revolutionary ideology about military service. The whole way people understand military service changes. And so, thinking specifically about the United States, but it's certainly not exclusive to the United States, this ability to, at short notice, call up millions of fighting men and deploy large armies. It's a very different world. And I guess I would say, that transportation, mass migration, and a new ideology of warfare—they all have to do with it.
We've spent the summer of 2020 doing all kinds of different things, and as we've been locked down, we've been watching real sharp episodes of conflict and violence in the United States and also here in the United Kingdom. And you and I are both North American expatriates. Statues are being torn down and history is relevant. It's good for those of us who are historians. We don't have to make the case for the relevance of our discipline just for a bit. I think the great value of this book is that it kind of reminds us that the founding of nations and states is something that is intimately tied up with violence. So, I mean, what do we have to, I mean, how do we have to sort of rethink violence in terms of where violence sits within national histories, because quite often national histories like to paper over violence and instead talk about mythological founding or origin stories or what have you. But when you put the centrality of violence and intercultural violence to boot in the center of the narrative, I mean, why is that important for us to recall as a historical lesson? That's a very long question, but that's the essence of it.
Okay. I think when you focus on violence, the whole question of whose perspective you are taking becomes very sharp, and the implications of taking different perspectives, I think, become clear. And I guess an example I would give would be the experience of the enslaved in the Caribbean. For many people who were brought to the Caribbean as slaves, that was only a year or two of their lives, and it came at the end of violent episodes of warfare or kidnapping or judicial action in Africa, confinement in a ship with the whole infrastructure of military force against them in the ship, and then arrival and a different kind of confinement in the Caribbean. If you think about Caribbean history with that, in the perspective that you know, for any period up until the early 19th century, certainly a huge proportion of the enslaved population are people just like that, who are basically surviving the last moments of a whole long violent episode. Then some of the questions people ask when they're doing Caribbean history don't really make that much sense anymore. We talk about what kind of society was Jamaica? Did they have a stable social order? And those questions seem. I mean, I'm not trying to argue that everybody should only look at it through the lens of violence, and this is the only way to look at it. But I'm just saying that when you do, different questions come up, and different ways of seeing, the colonies become clear.
I've been talking with Jeff Plank, the author of Atlantic Wars from the 15th Century to the Age of Revolution, published by Oxford University Press. It's a fabulous survey in three parts that takes us through and across and around the Atlantic world. Jeff, thanks very much for joining me on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me. Yep.